Hello and welcome to another of the Baseball America Prospect Profiles. We are profiling the number one prospect in each and every major league organization. And today we are talking about one of the better pure hitters on the prospect space, which is Cubs catcher slash DH, Moises Ballesteros, who is the Cubs' number one prospect. We saw him a little bit in the big leagues already. Jeff, you write the Cubs for us. When you think of Ballesteros and you think of that bat, what really kind of stands out to you? What makes him such a polished hitter?
Yeah, I think it's just barrel control. There's few hitters that, you know, can hit the locations and variety of shapes that Ballesteros can and sort of do what he wants to do with them. You know, it's hit over power still. There's still a fair amount of raw power kind of lurking underneath. But he's a contact hitter. He's a guy that's looking to put the ball sort of in play up the middle. More often than not, it's more line drives to the gap that, you know, end up going for extra bases for him. Certainly not a burner, not a guy that's going to steal a whole lot of bases or take an extra base all that often. So really has to slug, for those extra bases. You know, I think in terms of approach, not a guy that expands the zone a ton, but does chase a little bit kind of around the fringes of the zone. It's sort of hit pitch for him, in terms of, you know, sort of his approach at the plate. There is underlying power there. Not a guy that gets into a lot of pull side angles or tries to launch all that much. Maybe there's some tweaks that come, over time with him, but in terms of him hitting the ball hard, he hits the ball, I would say probably plus sort of EVs is maybe the best way to put it. 105.190th percentile EV this year, had a 112 in the minors. I think he actually had a 114 or 115 in the majors. He'll show it every so often. There was a home run that I witnessed at PNC Park late in the season, when Ballesteros was starting some games in September down the stretch for the Cubs, where he hit a ball almost clean out of PNC Park. So the impact is there. Whether or not he makes the tweaks to sort of get to that more consistently, remains to be seen, but I think is probably part of his profile that does need to grow, as there's not a whole lot of defensive value here. He does struggle a little bit, especially with impact against left-handed pitching. So he's really going to have to maximize the damage in that profile to consistently get at bats and stay in the lineup. That's kind of the questions that you have with Ballesteros, but certainly bat to ball and hitting for a higher batting average is never going to be one of them.
Ben, when we talk about pure hitters, one of the things that we see kind of time after time, just kind of like a good news, bad news thing, I would say with Ballesteros, he's listed at 5'8", and he's listed officially, I think, at 195, and I can promise you that that number is actually larger than that. But a 5'8" hitter, the problem for him is that that kind of does limit him as making first base a candidate, you know, a candidate to play some first base if he's not catching. But at the same time, it kind of also probably helps him a little bit as far as that bat control, that barrel control, having those shorter levers and all. As a hitter, you know, I think that you also kind of fall like I do in this kind of, hey, if you, there's sometimes some advantages to kind of having those short levers. What do you see from Ballesteros as a hitter and kind of how he can develop?
Yeah, he's just a really gifted hitter. I mean, we saw the swings in the video earlier. Everything is just so balanced and consistently on time. The bat path through the zone is really good, and it's just a really compact, adjustable swing with great barrel accuracy. We rarely see him swing and miss. It's been consistent throughout his career. He's done it up through AAA, through the highest levels of the minor leagues. And yeah, I mean, there's strength behind that swing too. I mean, I think his approach is geared more toward like being a hitter first and instead of trying to sell out for power, which I like. But I think it's a really talented hitter with some power in there. He is aggressive. I wish he'd tighten up the strike zone judgment just a little bit, but he's not like a free swinger by any means. I see him being potentially a Pablo Sandoval type hitter, somebody who, yeah, you know, people are going to write him off, or maybe earlier in his career would have written him off just because the body type, the way he looks physically. But don't overlook this guy as a hitter, because he's a really, really good hitter.
we talked about him as a hitter, Jeff. The other big question I think that Ballesteros faces, and the one that probably is a little bit more of kind of a big question mark he faces, is defensive home. He is a catcher. It is also hard to see him being the Cubs' everyday catcher, even if there was an injury this year. Where do you see him playing kind of in the short, medium, and long term? Is this a guy who can stay behind the plate, or is it more likely this is a bat who also can catch a little bit?
Yeah, I don't think you can completely write him off seeing 30 or 40 games behind the plate this year. And I think in that sense, you know, potentially he can stick behind the plate. He's still incredibly young, and, you know, he's 22 entering the season this year. And I think we need to sort of keep that in mind with catchers, even guys that have a wealth of college experience, high level experience, pressure experience. A lot of those guys still need to improve as receivers and blockers. You know, once they get into professional baseball, the fact that his bat is so advanced, I think, has maybe not done his glove so many favors. And I think, you know, he still needs some time back there to learn it. You know, we've written off guys with this body type before. We've seen Alejandro Kirk turn into one of the better blockers in the game, and a guy that's really sure-handed back there, was kind of on display in the World Series last year. I don't think he's going to turn into an Alejandro Kirk type defender, but I do think that it's reasonable to think that that's his primary position. He sees some time as a DH. He has played some first base, but not a tremendous amount. There's better options there, I think, with Michael Bush under contract for quite a long time. So for me with Ballesteros, it's probably going to be predominantly catcher and DH. But I do think he'll still see some time back there. There might be maybe particular pitchers that he feels comfortable working with, and they kind of get him on a schedule in that sense. But I don't think they're going to completely move him off of the position. And I think it's one of the things that the Cubs really value about Ballesteros, and one of the things that will probably keep him, you know, in the major league active roster for a long time.
So those are the things that we kind of want to watch for Ballesteros in 2026. How much is he going to play catcher? How much is he going to get to face lefties? This probably could start out with him being a guy who predominantly faces right-handers, but you want to see him get that chance. As Jeff mentioned, this is a guy who's still very young for a guy who's going to be in the big leagues. And then long-term, we just really believe in the bat. When you say, well, why is this guy the number one prospect in the Cubs organization? It's because it's been laid out. He can really, really hit. You take this kind of hitting ability, and it gives you the opportunity to kind of develop and kind of settle in at the big league level. He doesn't have the clear holes. He doesn't have the swing and miss issues that likely could derail a guy from ever really getting settled in at the big league level. Now it's just about the opportunity and taking advantage of it. And we expect Moises Ballesteros to do that in 2026. He is the number one prospect in the Cubs organization and the latest of these Baseball America prospect profiles. Hello to another Baseball America prospect profile as we go through the number one prospects in each and every Major League Baseball organization. Jeff, today we're talking about a guy who I would say is when you're talking about Rookie of the Year candidates, he gets forgotten a little bit, but Reds third baseman, second baseman, first baseman, Sal Stewart is someone that you should pay attention to because he's one of the guys who I think has the clearest path to regular at-bats in 2026. What has you excited about Sal Stewart?
Yeah, I think it's obviously the bat. This isn't some standout athlete. It's not somebody who's going to provide a ton of defensive value. I don't know, you know, what's the under-over even is on whether he'll ever see five games at third base in the major leagues. Could play a little second, probably mostly first base. But you're buying into the power breakout in 2025. The underlying power and physicality were obviously always there. He's a bigger guy, you know, a little bit more portly build, but generated some bat speed, but was more of a hitter with some power and never really fully tapped into that. The angles were a little bit flatter, but making contact, bat to ball, good swing decisions, none of that stuff was ever standing in Stewart's way. It was just a matter of sort of hitting the ball as hard as he could at good angles without sacrificing too much of those plate skills. He did that in 2025 and skyrocketed up to the major leagues. It's obviously one of the cushiest landing spots as well if he's getting full-time playing time. If you need a park that's going to help your power play up a little bit and cushion your numbers a little bit, you know, Great America Ballpark is one of the best places to probably hit in the major leagues, JJ. So I think you probably agree that, you know, it's a bat-first prospect. That's what's really driving the profile with Stewart. But it's a pretty good one and has really good sort of underlying foundational hit tool skills that back the power and everything else. So could be a guy that, you know, has a very long major league career.
So when I look at Sal Stewart, the thing that jumps out, like you said about the defense, I would say there are, I think this is the first baseman. I think that this is the Reds' first baseman. They've been looking for one of those. I know Spencer Steer can play there. They've tried Christian Encarnacion Strand, but I think this is your first baseman for years to come. And I think that's probably best for the Reds and best for him. He has played a lot of third base coming up through the minors. We wrote about it at Baseball America. His arm would be the worst arm of any third baseman in the major leagues unless it improves dramatically. It was last year at the end of the year. He can play second base. I would say that's a little bit more of a viable position for him, but he's going to be a well below average range, well below average athleticism there at second base. They have better second basemen. Matt McClain is a much better second baseman than Sal Stewart. But you look at first base, look at DH, and like you said, Jeff, this is a guy who's going to hit, who should hit enough to where that's where his contribution is going to come. And it's a little bit different than some of the other guys that they've tried at first base. When you look at Sal Stewart, this is a hit first profile who, as you said, is now getting to power. I love guys who have that kind of profile. Sal Stewart's always been able to hit. He's always used to hold field. Now he's starting to be able to pull the ball and do damage when he gets a pitch to hit, in addition to the fact that he really does make the pitcher kind of use the entire zone. And if you know that if you come in on him now, he can do damage to you. But if you stay away, he's also perfectly happy to just flick the ball to the opposite field. He'll take his bases. I think that this is a guy who could hit 270, 280, maybe even better than that down the road with some power potential as well. Put that together. This could fill what is, I would say, very much a need for the Reds, because when you look at the Reds and you say, what have they lacked? Well, again, when you look at the difference between him and, say, like Christian Encarnacion Strand, Christian Encarnacion Strand has great power potential, but the problem is chases a lot of pitches out of the zone, a lot of contact issues. It's a very much a flip to a guy like Sal Stewart, who is going to work counts, is going to make it difficult for you he's not just going to give you easy outs very often. He's not going to run all that great. Like we said, he's not going to give you a ton of defense, but there's enough here to really be a productive and an important middle of the lineup bat for the Reds potentially over the long term. But Jeff, when you look at kind of these hitters developing into power, like you said, he started to show signs of it last year. What are the parts of it that you're looking at and saying, okay, this is where I feel like that this is a guy? Because when you look at the EVs with him, it does offer some signs there that the exit velocities are there and all for this guy to have real power potential as well. Right? This is not a slap hitter.
No, not at all. And, you know, I think you sort of hit the nail on the head that, you know, he will take what a pitcher gives him. And he's also a guy that more often than not is going to put the ball in play. I think that's going to be his profile. He's not going to be somebody running, 14% walk rates or anything like that, but he's going to run a high batting average. He's going to give you really competitive at bats because he has power. You kind of have to respect him on certain parts within the strike zone. And I think that's where he really took that step forward was, identifying certain counts, certain locations, certain pitch types that he could do damage on. And that's when, you will see him sort of get into some pull side power, which is not something that he had done, consistently in the early seasons of his professional career. Now as a major leaguer, he's doing that. I think he had like over a 17% barrel rate last year at the major league level. It was kind of similar throughout his tenure in the minors last year. And then, you just kind of look at the basic underlying stats. There's not a whole lot of guys in the game or prospects for that matter that run, an excellent in-zone whiff rate of like 17.5% last year across all levels with a 106.9 90th percentile EV. There's just not a lot of guys like that. Now, he also balances swing decisions in a really sort of aggressive way, but not overly aggressive. He attacks a lot of stuff in the zone, doesn't chase a ton. It's more of like an average chase rate, but he's a fairly aggressive swinger. So when you put that in context, more often than not, his swings come on pitches in the zone, come on strikes. And he was running, you know, high barrel rates all throughout the year. The angles got steeper in terms of, you know, the point of contact, whether it was just plain overall launch angle, hard hit launch angle, or pull launch angle, all that stuff increased. And that's the reason he's getting to more power now and will continue to going forward, like I said, and especially in Cincinnati.
So if you've been paying attention to the Reds for a while, you maybe, you know, I said that Sal Stewart, I think, is the first baseman of the future for the Reds. You may be asked the question, well, what about Cam Collier? Cam Collier, obviously, first round pick of the Reds, not that many years ago. Stewart and Collier kind of came up together. They were kind of doing a job share at third base for multiple years. Then this past season, Cam Collier got hurt in spring training, missed the first half of the season. And that kind of meant that Stewart kind of, his timetable was a little bit ahead of Collier. He got to be the everyday third baseman in Chattanooga, AA for first half season, moves up to AAA, not around, long around the time that Cam Collier kind of moved to AA. Then Stewart made it to the big leagues. So Stewart kind of has that first mover advantage now. He is there. He is going to get a chance to stake a claim to the position. There is a DH as well. It's not like these two guys couldn't coexist, but you are talking about two first basemen for a team that has really struggled to have a first baseman for quite a while since Joey Votto retired. This is a team now that has two first basemen who one will be in the big leagues and one will probably be in AAA ready to go. So there's a little bit of depth that's developing here. And that's our prospect profile on Reds number one prospect, first baseman, second baseman, third baseman, Sal Stewart. We're back for another of the Baseball America prospect profiles as we look at the number one prospect in each and every one of the 30 MLB organizations. And today is a fun one because we are talking about one of the best prospects in baseball, J.J. Weatherholt, the Cardinals shortstop, although we'll talk about that and kind of where defensively he may end up. But shortstop J.J. Weatherholt, who ranks number three on the Baseball America top 100. Jeff, Weatherholt has been one of the best young hitters pretty much wherever he's played, going back to college where he was a D1 batting champ at West Virginia, looking in his pro debut in 2020. Significant pro debut in 25, where he dominated at multiple levels. J.J. Weatherholt really can hit, but that's not all he can do, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the things that sort of gets lost in the conversation about J.J. Weatherholt. Yeah, he could be, you know, one of the few 300 hitters in the next couple of years. I really think that, you know, the underlying skills are there. We'll talk about that later, but I think the overall package here is something that definitely gets a little undersold. It's a guy that, you know, if it wasn't for Mason Wynn being the Cardinal starting shortstop for the foreseeable future, he could be a guy that would come up and fill that position right away. He's an above average defender at shortstop. I think would, you know, easily be maybe plus at third base, plus at second base if he ended up there. But a guy that can play multiple spots in the infield, it's an above average arm. He's, you know, a plus to, you know, above average runner maybe as he matures a little bit, but does move, can steal bases, will take those extra bases. There's, you know, range in the infield. I think we really saw like the total package of J.J. Weatherholt in 2025, which was something that we missed a little bit. Got, you know, robbed from us because of his injury in 2024's final season at West Virginia before coming into the draft. And I think now you can see why he was in conversations for that number one pick in a really stacked draft class, especially on the college hitting side. When we look back with guys like Nick Kurtz, et cetera, Weatherholt to me is right there in terms of what the future projection is, what this player can be. I think we're talking about a guy that can make multiple all-star teams. And a lot of that, JJ, I'm sure you would agree, is this hit tool. You know, it's that combination of excellent bat to ball skills with really pristine, you know, discerning eye at the plate in terms of his swing decisions, really expands the zone and is very aggressive within. And that's what makes for a great hit tool. I think the only contemporary he has in this top 100 list or amongst top prospects right now is probably Kevin McGonigal.
I agree with that. If you're a Cardinals fan, I remember it wasn't that long ago, 2024 draft, you're sitting there, what are you going to get at pick 7? And they were rightfully thrilled The Cardinals themselves were thrilled to get Weatherholt. You get a guy who was taken seventh overall in 24, and here we are. He's the number three prospect in the game 2 years later. Okay, Nick Kurtz was taken ahead of him. Nick Kurtz has graduated and that, you know, had a rookie of the year season. But to be the number three prospect like he is, and I do think that people, like, we've got a lot of Baseball America doing a study, you know, recently that just lays out, like, a number three prospect, a number one, two, or three prospect in the game. Historically, we've done the Baseball America Top 100 now. This is our 37th year. Historically, more than half of those players go on to be what I would describe as stars, 20-plus WAR players. More than three-quarters of them go on to be solid long-term regulars, 10-plus WAR players. J.J. Weatherholt's expectation at this point, I think it is reasonable to think that this is a player who's going to be playing for the Cardinals for years to come. I know that the Cardinals have had kind of their run of players who, you know, we're looking at Dylan Carlson and Jordan Walker, and you could even throw maybe Nolan Gorman in there a little bit and say, okay, these players haven't panned out to the full level that was expected when they came up. J.J. Weatherholt, Jeff, to me, is a different level of prospect. I feel much more confident that there's very little on the to-do list here as he heads into the 2026 season. There's not many things I look at and say, oh, this is really a potential risk that could really trip up J.J. Weatherholt. I feel like it's more of a question of he's either going to be a very solid player or then he's going to be a star, but it's really hard to see him just completely falling on his face and not being a multi-year regular and productive regular for the Cardinals. Am I crazy to think that, or what do you view it as?
No, because I think when you talk about, you know, Dylan Carlson, who early on in his professional career looked like he was headed that way, things really sort of cratered. It was, you know, Jordan Walker had glimpses and it's just never taken off. But I will say, when you just look at, particularly in Walker's case, you know, it was the big power, it was the angles, it was, you know, sort of dreaming on the athleticism. But we were asking questions, where is he going to play defensively? You know, some of the swing mechanics at times and some of the swing decisions and some of the bat to ball in zone was a little bit concerning. That's not the case with Weatherholt. Weatherholt is extremely polished at the plate. And what that does is it gives you a high degree of confidence that all of these skills are going to translate at the next level, because they have translated as he's moved up and faced more advanced competition and, you know, finished the season in AAA and spent about half the year there with Memphis and put up excellent numbers. You know, had the Cardinals been in contention, then there might have been a reason for them to call him up. You see the Nolan Arenado trade go down. It looks like he's probably going to be in that infield picture, I would imagine, from day one as a starter. You look at those skills, the bat-to-ball skills, 15.6% in-zone whiff rate across all competitions, a 17.4% chase rate with a 41.7% swing rate, which means, you know, there's a pretty big delta there, one of the bigger deltas between his chase and swing rate, and that shows us that he's more aggressive in the zone, like I said. This is a 70-hit tool. These guys typically translate, and as he moved up and you know, spent more time in AAA, really started to get into more game power and impacting the baseball a little bit more. He talked with us about it at the Futures game and then really took off in that second half. So I'm pretty confident that he's going to come up, hit for some power, really hit for average, get on base and be, you know, one of the cogs really at the top of that Cardinals lineup for at least the next half decade.
Okay. You mentioned also, this is the guy who we expect to be in the opening day lineup. Are we almost surprised at this point? The Arenado trade kind of opens it up. If Mason Wynn's there, we got a Gold Glove shortstop on the team, so he's not going to play shortstop. But I do think it's worth noting that if Mason Wynn went down for 2 months or something, it's not implausible to think that Weatherholt could play there. You know, we're kind of saying he's going to move more because they have a great defensive shortstop than it is that he clearly is just incapable of playing the position. Or how would you describe his defense at second? It's a little hard to describe his second and third as much because he's played much more shortstop. But how do you see him kind of projecting at the different positions, kind of depending a little bit on best fit, you know, for the Cardinals team and figuring out how they put these puzzle pieces together in what is still a little bit of a complicated picture?
Yeah, you know, I think probably, you know, he's above average at shortstop, and it's an above average arm that I think is good enough to stick on the left side of the infield, which tells me he could potentially be plus at third base. I think the hands, the actions, the internal clock, he knows how to play the position. you know, there's range there. You know, he's not Mason Wynn. He's not Omar Vizquel. It's not going to be somebody that really covers just the entire infield. But, you know, it wouldn't shock me if he's one of the better defensive third basemen in the game. Second base-wise, middle infielder, has played there, I think would be a fairly natural transition for him. Certainly more than enough arm to turn those double plays, and enough range that I think, you know, could be a really standout defender at second base. So there's no questions, and I know that's exactly what the organization thinks as well. They view him very highly in terms of his defense, the work that he puts in there, and just all the tools and skills that he has as an infield defender, that he's going to be above average or plus no matter where they put him.
So that is JJ Weatherholt, the top prospect in the Cardinals organization and one of the top prospects in all of baseball, on the latest of Baseball America Prospect Profiles. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Baseball America Prospect Profile. We are looking at the number one prospect in all 30 MLB organizations, and today we're looking at one of the best. Brewers shortstop Jesus Mate ranks very high on the Baseball America Top 100. Ben, you do our Brewers list, but not only that, you also kind of spearhead our international amateur coverage. So I'll start by just kind of asking, take us through kind of the development and the path of Jesus Mate from intriguing amateur to one of the best prospects in the game.
Yeah, Jesus Mate was one of the Brewers' top prospects in their 2024 international signing class out of the Dominican Republic. Credit to the Brewers, because obviously they signed him. They signed Luis Peña in that same class. I don't think anybody, including the Brewers, expected Jesus Mate to be doing the things that he's doing right now as an 18-year-old. He was great, obviously, in the Dominican Summer League in his debut in 2024. We ranked him as the number one prospect in the Brewers farm system when he was 17, coming off that DSL season. It was very aggressive. Sometimes things don't translate outside of the DSL when guys come over to the States, but that one is aging pretty well right now. I don't know how much more you can ask for from an 18-year-old shortstop. I mean, he just does everything that you want to see in a young hitter. I mean, switch hitter who makes good swing decisions. He has a really nice swing from both sides of the plate, great barrel accuracy, so there's very little swing and miss, and a lot of bat speed too. He hits the ball hard. He's a good athlete, runs well, throws well. To be determined if he ends up staying at shortstop. You know, it maybe depends on who else is on the team. Cooper Pratt in the organization, I think, is a better pure defender at shortstop and probably gets to Milwaukee first. But whether you put him at shortstop, second base, third base, wherever you want to put him in the infield, the bat, the upside is there for him to be a star.
And Jeff, Ben talked about this, but I remember talking to you about when Mate was coming up out of the DSL. One of the reasons that we felt so comfortable being so aggressive with him was the rare kind of mix of hitting ability, power, and plate discipline here. This is a guy who, even as a 17-year-old, was already showing all the hallmarks of being kind of an elite, well-rounded hitter, wasn't he?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's even more impressive when you consider the fact that, you know, Mate is a switch hitter. So it's not like it's just numbers where he's kind of perfected stuff from one side. It's very clear that, you know, there's two different swings and all those splits, et cetera, all baked into his numbers. He's a guy that makes a tremendous amount of contact, I think, especially when you consider the fact that he is a switch hitter that hits for power. Usually those few things aren't synonymous when we're talking about hitters. You don't necessarily get guys who are switch hitters who are contact and power guys. Usually it's one or the other. He balances that really well. You know, the approach at times, I think, can border on passive, but still very rarely swings himself into outs, especially, you know, in the left-handed hitting batting batter's box against right-handers. He's not a guy that's expanding the zone a little bit more when he's facing lefties as a right-handed hitter, but has the power from both sides of the plate. That's really, really consistent. you know, he's, you know, was 18 years old this year playing in full season ball at the age, a lot of these guys, even good prospects that are signing in the international market, typically aren't skipping domestic complex leagues. He did that. He goes right up to low A, where he spent a majority of his season, but continued to impress and sort of level up as he reached high A and then double A by the end of the season. And I think that's also sort of a marker of elite prospects, is they don't just sort of meet the challenge of the league they're in. Each time that they're presented a new challenge, they get a little bit better. They improve a little bit. And I think we saw that with Made. And, you know, I think the other thing that I wanted to go into a little bit too is just the EVs. They're really impressive for a guy who's as young and sort of the size that he is. He's not a small guy, but he's probably 6 foot, 6 foot one, maybe 190, 200 pounds. And he's putting up above major league average, you know, average exit velocities, 90th percentile exit velocities, and then max exit velocities. As the angles get a little bit better, I think this is a guy that could grow into 25 plus kind of home run power.
So you mentioned, Ben, that the Brewers right now are stand out as one of the teams doing some of the, one of the best jobs on the international market. You mentioned we got Jackson Chourio kind of started this run. We have Abner Uribe, and now we have, you know, we have Made, we have Luis Peña, we have more to come. It wasn't that long ago. If you flip it back a decade, basically the Brewers were arguably, other than the Orioles who weren't trying, the worst at producing big leaguers. There was a, from 2012 to 2018, you know, 2017, I should say, they signed one big leaguer in five classes, and they were giving a lot of effort to it. What has changed? What kind of is the approach changed? Have kind of the leadership changed? What has changed that's kind of turned the Brewers kind of into an international amateur juggernaut?
Yeah, everything changed. They rehired staff down there in the Dominican Republic and Venezuela as well. They changed at the time. They hired Mike Grootman, who's now an assistant GM with the Red Sox, to run their international program. Now James Armstrong runs it, but you know, hiring people like him, those guys, Luis Perez, Fernando Verasierto, two of their top scouts who are also very heavily involved in scouting players in Venezuela, which obviously presents a whole lot of other challenges that you don't find in the Dominican Republic or other countries throughout Latin America. So you've seen them signing, you know, guys like Jackson Chourio, Jefferson Caro, some other good players from Venezuela, guys like Jader Arenamo, they traded to the Rays. But yeah, I think that they just implemented, you know, and they've hired a whole bunch of other people on the ground in those countries, but they've implemented a very, very thorough process where it's hard because you have to, you know, you're scouting players essentially who are now, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old in Latin America and having to make decisions very early on. So it's hard to build history or feel a ton of confidence in your evaluations and projections on those players. But I think they do a very good job of, you know, building history early on those players, gathering a lot of information, and just having a lot of good scouts on the ground too, who work hard and know what they're looking at when they do see these guys, to be able to, you know, identify them early.
So Jesus Made is not only the Brewers' number one prospect. When we are looking, he is one of the top prospects in the game right now. But the other thing that stands out here is when we look at the players who are near the top of the Baseball America 2026 Top 100 heading into the season, Made is probably the only one at the very top of that list who is unlikely to graduate in 2026. He could graduate, but we've said this a couple of times before, I believe, at baseballamerica.com, but Made's very much on the Jackson Chourio timetable. If you look, Chourio ended the year that his low A year, started in low A, went high A, then finished with six games in double A. Made did effectively the same thing, just ended it with five games in double A. Chourio then spent the entirety of that next season, with the exception of a very tail end cup of coffee at triple A, spent almost all the year at double A. Wouldn't be shocking to see Made do the same thing, make it to triple A end of the year, but he should be still eligible, prospect eligible heading into 2027, which also makes him likely our top candidate to be the number one prospect in the game if he develops as we continue to expect in 2027. Jesus Made, Milwaukee Brewers' number one prospect. Thank you for joining us on another of the Prospect Profiles. AJ Cooper, Jeff Ponce here, another Baseball America prospect profile. And today we are talking about the number one prospect in the game, number one prospect, Pittsburgh Pirates shortstop slash center fielder, Connor Griffin. Connor Griffin coming off of an exceptional season where he started in low A, ended in double A. If you look at those tools grades, they are louder than loud. It is not often that you see a guy with that many plus tools. Jeff, obviously we can talk about the plus tools. We can talk about the athleticism. What is the first thing that comes to mind for you having seen Connor Griffin in person multiple occasions now, what stands out to you?
Yeah, we're playing the word association game, explosiveness. I think that's the first thing that comes to mind because it's something you see in all facets of his game, whether it's the first time you see him swing an actual bat and make contact. He's just able to explode with, sort of an ease that few athletes can match. And it's really high output in terms of the power, lots of contact and high quality of contact, which is a rare combination for a player, fresh out of high school for all intents and purposes. One of the best runners in the minor leagues in top of the scale speed, a guy who can play multiple positions in shortstop and center field. They're incredibly valuable, up the middle type profile, could be double plus in center field because of how explosive he is on his jumps and reads and how much makeup speed he has because of that speed we talked about. And it's the same thing in the infield. And it's rare that guys sort of have that type of explosiveness that can translate to, both the grass and the dirt defensively. And that's just a part of his game. We're not even that excited about the defense. We are. But the thing that really gets us excited, JJ, is the quality of that hit tool with that power and that speed. And just kind of, looking long term, could be a potential offensive monster and one of the biggest stars in baseball. That's the sort of upside we're looking at with this player now.
It is. It's something where you don't want to go overboard here, but anything that you start to kind of compare him to past players, you start going what feels like overboard. If you said, where is he now? And you compare it to Bobby Witt Jr. when he was kind of coming up, it's a very similar tool set. If you look at their tools grades that we had at roughly the same ages, they're very similar. Although I would say that Connor Griffin's hit tool is probably a little further along than we thought Bobby Witt Jr.'s was at the time. And then Bobby Witt Jr. went out and eventually, was battling for batting titles already in the big leagues. When you look at him physically, I can't help but, bring up what a young Mike Trout looked like, because he has that kind of chiseled body, that kind of neck that seems to go, basically four sizes too big for his head. He is a physical specimen. And then you talk about the hitting ability, because Jeff, we've talked about this on the Hot Sheet show before. His hitting ability was kind of the big question coming out of high school. Everything else already stood out. And then you see what he did in 2025, the improvements he's made, over last offseason between 24, his pro debut, and 25. And you see a guy who has already demonstrated that he can diagnose and adjust and make real significant adjustments that improve him as a player. And that, I feel like we feel so much better about his hit tool now than we did at this time a year ago.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you made the Bobby Witt Jr. comparison, and I think it's a great comparison point as to top of the scale athletes with speed and power. Of course, the infield defense. And I think that's what makes Griffin so unique is now Witt, obviously with 2020 and everything that happened, we did not get a minor league season, sort of like that platform year off of the draft, like we just got with Griffin. Griffin got up to double A, spent a good chunk of his season, above low A, so in high A and double A. And you look at the contact rate. We talk about the hit tool and the improvements there, the questions about, is he going to make enough contact? Is he really going to hit for impact? He did both of those things. And, I think he, really answered those questions with a resounding, absolutely. I have big power. I get to it in games. I don't have to sacrifice, the contact. was something that Roman Anthony, when, you know, he was named the number one prospect a few years back, when we had done the interview with him, the one thing he kind of always called to mind was that he was a hitter with power. And I think it's kind of a similar example with Griffin. And I think the hit tool might even be better than what it was with Anthony, with very similar power. And he's even younger and has all those tools to decorate it. But I mean, just comparing him to Bobby Witt Jr., you look at his, you know, in zone whiff rate this season of 17.1%, where in 2021, which was Witt's final season in the minor leagues, he had a 26% zone miss rate. So when you're comparing the hit tool and the hit tool risk of these players, as they potentially, you know, obviously Witt entered his rookie season, and Griffin now looking like he could be entering his rookie season in 2026, the quality, the consistency of contact isn't even really close, JJ.
The other thing that you've mentioned before is there's real defensive value here too. Now, it could be center field. It's probably going to be shortstop. I don't think that you move a guy like this off of shortstop, because you saw him in the postseason. You saw him in the postseason, the Eastern League playoffs, and just watching the ease with which he does it. There's a clock, the internal clock. There are the shortstop skills to go with the arm, to go with the burst, to go with the athleticism, the range. Was there any aspect of, you know, when you've talked to evaluators or seeing him in person, any aspect of him at shortstop where you say, you know, that might become a problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could potentially look at the size of Griffin. He's 6'3", 6'4". It's a bigger frame, bigger body. But we've seen guys like that stick at shortstop, and I don't know if many of them have been this athletic, right? So that's another part that sort of makes Griffin very unique. There's not a whole lot that I think you can knock. The hands, the action, the arm is great. It's a plus-plus arm. Was, you know, a pretty good prospect as a pitcher in high school as well. If he didn't have all this hitting ability, probably a guy that would have gone in the first few rounds. So I think there is a lot of optimism around him sticking at shortstop now, where that kind of wasn't the conversation coming into last season, or even early on, or coming out of spring training. And once again, he really proved that, no, I'm a shortstop long term. So yeah, when he was in the field as Kevin McGonigal, same field as Kevin McGonigal on the other side, top prospect, another guy that's a shortstop, it was pretty clear that Griffin was the guy between the two that's going to stick at the position long term.
There are they're basically, when you look at where Griffin is right now, you could absolutely see the case. This is a guy who just got to Double A late in last season. You could make the case that, okay, send him to Triple A, give him some more time. But at the same time, I just want to point out, for one, Connor Griffin is a guy who is going to be one of the best players in spring training for the Pirates. That's just a reality. That was true kind of last year when he was fresh-faced and had basically no pro experience, and he was already making kind of highlight plays day after day in spring training. So there's that. But then on top of that, you have the fact that the Pirates just went through it with Paul Skeens, where they sent him back to the minors, brought him up not long into the season, but long enough that they no longer qualified to win an extra pick, a prospect performance incentive, a PPI, if he came up and then won the Rookie of the Year, won Cy Young. They would have had a pick if they had. And by the way, they didn't get a service time benefit either, because if you win an award like that, you get a full year of service for that first year. So there may be some incentive to bring Connor Griffin up. He is the number one prospect in the game, easily the number one prospect in the Pirates organization. Thank you for joining us for another of these prospect profiles. If you enjoyed this, we are rolling out one every day during spring training. The number one prospect, we're talking about everyone, the number one prospect in every organization. So check out the Baseball America YouTube channel, and we'll see you on another of the prospect profiles.